Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
Pacers last night, impressive against the Nets of Brooklyn. Jake Query here along with Jimmy Cook, Eddie Garrison as well, joining us now on the guest line. The wildly popular, often used, and shockingly unsponsored guest line is Dustin Dopierak. I got it right. Right, Eddie?
You did.
Dustin, man. Let me tell you something. That's a red letter day, brother.
That's like hitting and my apologies on that,
Dustin.
Fairway.
I don't know why. Listen, I mean, my last name's Query, so I should be very sensitive to this. I don't know why that's a mental hurdle for me, so I apologize. But
no, you don't have to apologize, Jake. You're like the thousandth person who gets it wrong. Like everybody gets it wrong. You're good, man.
Okay,
I promise you're good.
Is Tyrese Haliburton out of his slump?
I think so. I mean, I think you can, I don't know that you're seeing him at the top of his powers, I guess, at this point. But, I mean, you're looking at this most recent stretch. I think he's hit at least 2 threes in each game. I think it was 5 in a row, I want to say. I just looked this up last night. So I'm looking for which, basketball reference tab I have open with his game logs to make sure I'm right about that. But yeah, I mean, I think, you're seeing this, the stroke seems to be there. I mean, he's not lights out from three right now, but I mean, he's not to the point where you're like, man, is he getting made for it? I mean, I think so. Yeah, he's hit at least 3 in each of his last 4 games. He hit at least 2 in each of his last 6. I think in the last 6 games, he's shooting around 44.9% from 3. Again, not lights out, but, pretty good number, a little bit better than his average. You're also seeing him continue to hit the floaters and whatnot. But I think he's reached the point that he's at least, back to that level. And he's not peak Haliburton. I think you also see that there's still a difference in how he's being defended, therefore how he has to play. His role is different since they traded Buddy Hield. He's playing off the ball more, doing a lot more off the ball movement and setting screens and stuff like that. So it changes his game, and you're not seeing the 30s and 40 point nights. But I think he's out. He's past the point where you have to worry like, man, is he ever going to hit one again?
Dustin Dopierak of the Indy Star is our guest. Dustin, as you look at the Pacers from a rotational standpoint, handful of games left before we get into play-in versus playoffs, but we discussed earlier the play of Isaiah Jackson, especially last night. We've highlighted as well the play of Jairus Walker over the last couple of weeks. Of those two, who is most likely to be on the, maybe not outside of the rotation, but have minutes cut and turn to potentially when needed? Like, who is the one that's the backup in that role? Who is the one that is the clear, no, if we need to go deep on the bench for depth at the 4 or the 5, this is who we're going to if you're matching up Walker and Jackson at this stage?
Well, I mean, you don't think of them similarly because, I mean, like, Walker has become more of a perimeter player to the point of being a 3. Jackson is very clearly the number 3-5. And so if Miles Turner has to miss any amount of time with this finger issue, then, Isaiah Jackson is the backup center. I mean, he just slots right in. Obviously, he hasn't developed any kind of perimeter game that you could say, oh, we could try him at the 4, or we could try him. He's a 5. He is a, athletic, rim-running, lob finishing, shot-blocking 5. Obviously Jalen Smith still has the edge on him, as the backup, because Jalen Smith can hit threes on occasion. Whenever one of those guys gets in foul trouble, whenever a third five is needed, Isaiah Jackson is a third five, whether that's for injury reasons, whether that's for foul reasons, which can obviously, be an issue when you're talking about centers where people are driving the ball at them all the time. I think he's that is his job. And so obviously whatever playing time he gets is determined largely by whatever happens with Miles Turner and Jalen Smith, and I don't think he's going to jump one of those two guys at this point in the season, but he's still a critical piece, that if you need a third center, and you might, he's that guy. I mean, Walker, obviously, there are more moving parts involved, and I think that's kind of more based on, the style of the play, what they feel like they need. I mean, really, it's between him and Doug McDermott right now for the last spot on the second unit, and they're both playing, you're seeing them both get minutes. Walker is obviously, I think, the guy that if you're like, okay, if you need somebody to create, somebody to pass somebody to, you know, defend some bigger guys because he has come a long way defensively, you know, rebound a little bit. Basically, if you need somebody to kind of be a little bit, you know, tougher, you go for Walker. If you need the shooting, you go for McDermott. And you're starting to see McDermott make some shots and be what he was in Indiana the first time when he was acquired, you know, to be to some extent in the Hield deal. So I think that's kind of the Walker-McDermott is kind of the more interesting battle for me. But I think I think Ricardo is going to end up playing both. I mean, I asked him about that a couple games ago, and he said, you know, I'm not like married to either one of them, but you know, they both bring different skill sets, and we're going to need both of them. So, you know, I'm keeping both of them as options. You know, because again, it just depends on what you need at that moment in terms of which one of those you're playing.
Dustin, you touched on it a little bit there, but I want to get back into it. Miles Turner, for those that are not familiar, last night, you know, jammed his finger. I guess, was it dislocated? I don't know what the exact diagnosis was.
They used the term dislocated.
Okay.
They used the term dislocated, and the picture I saw was gruesome. But
yeah,
they managed to get that thing back in place.
As soon as he, like the whole bench looked like they were about to pass out when they saw it. But have they, or when do we expect to know any sort of a timeline there?
Something will come out today when the injury report drops, because obviously they got a game tomorrow. So somewhere in the five, you know, usually between, you know, like the 4:30 injury report and the 6:30 injury report, you know, you see, you'll see that come out there, 7:30 tip tomorrow. So it'll be 4:30 or 5:30 on that. They're not practicing today, or at least they're not having any required practice today, which basically just means it's not open to media. So we're not going to talk to Rick, and we're not going to talk to anybody else. So our first indication as to where Miles stands is going to be with the injury report. I mean, but, you know, Carlisle did say last night that x-rays came back negative for a break, for a fracture. So that's obviously a big step in that right direction, in a positive direction for him. They you know, noted it as a sprain when they basically said he wasn't going to return. Rick used the term dislocation. It seems like, okay, well, it's not broke, and that helps.
Eddie, we have the breaking news sounder by chance. Dustin, I want you to partake in this. This just in from the NBA. The NBA today announced the finalists for the 2023-2024 Twyman Stokes Teammate of the Year Award, recognizing the player deemed to be the best teammate based on selfless play, on and off court leadership, and a mentor and model role to other NBA players in commitment and dedication to the team. One of the finalists for the award is an Indiana Pacer. Jimmy, I will let you pick, and then we will let Dustin opine on why that player was selected. Go ahead.
I'm going to go with a crowd favorite. I'm going to go TJ McConnell.
Do we have the ding, 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 ding sounder, Eddie? Because that is indeed correct. Dustin, your thoughts on that, and for those that are not around it, why TJ McConnell is fitting for that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it fits on a whole lot of levels. I mean, I think, it's interesting to go back to opening night when Rick Carlisle came in basically and told us that he had a conversation where he felt like he was almost in tears telling TJ that he wasn't going to start the year in the rotation, because obviously they were trying to get Andrew Nembhard minutes as the backup point guard. And it just became very clear very soon that McConnell was going to have to play, and you know that they were going to need him, because McConnell remains, in Carlisle's words, one of their most competitive players. And the guy has just brought it every single night. And, you know, I mean, he's also, you know, just like the energy is always there. I mean, he picks things up. I mean, you don't lose. You know, you go from Tyrese Haliburton, who is one of the fastest playing point guards in the league, and when you put McConnell in, you don't lose any pace. I mean, like, obviously McConnell is not going to be the reliable, for the most part, outside shooter that, you know, Haliburton is. But, you know, he's just been able to so frequently just get to the paint and get his shot over and over again, create for others, defend, you know, be a pain in the butt for 94 feet, you know, steal inbounds passes, do all the things he does. You know, like, basically just get everybody's energy level up. I mean, even when, you know, you've certainly seen nights with this team where they just look like they haven't had it. You know, that you don't see nights like that with McConnell. McConnell has it every night. He's, like, trying to bring everybody else up. And I think, you know, like, beyond, you know, what you see on the floor, I mean, like, McConnell's a really good mentor for a lot of guys. I mean, like, he's got this sort of interesting sense of humor, and, like, his, you know, he has these sort of mentorships that he spends a lot of time just sort of, you know, ragging on these guys, but they also grow a lot when they're around him. I think, you know, Nembhard was kind of his guy last year. Ben Shepherd has kind of been his guy this year. We'll walk in at pregame, and he's always, you know, talking to them and, like, making fun of them on something, but trying to get them, you know, to understand what it means to be a pro at this level. And you see this, the growth that those guys make. So, I mean, like, it's really, I mean, you definitely see what makes him not just a really good player, not just a guy that maintains a high level for this group and that they can depend on a nightly basis, but also a guy that matters in the locker room, and a guy that matters organizationally for what they're trying to do.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Pacers beat writer for the Indy Star, Dustin Dupirak, is our guest. Dustin, which boat would you rather be in at this stage in the race for the sixth seed? For the Pacers, they are up effectively a game over Miami in the totality of the standings. Miami still, though, has two more games to play. So let's lay out these scenarios. Again, Pacers are up right now in the standings by a game and a half. They have six to play, no back-to-backs. The Heat have eight games to play, one back-to-back still mixed in there, and there's that showdown in Indiana 5 days from today that could wind up having massive ramifications. Where would you rather be, at least in terms of positioning right now? In the Pacers' boat, up in the standings, but knowing Miami still has two games to play? Or in Miami's boat, knowing that you are chasing down Indiana, but you still have two games to make up the ground, plus that showdown this Sunday to make up as well?
I mean, in a vacuum, you'd rather be Indiana because you have the game at home. I think you look at the rest of the Heat schedule, I mean, leading up to that, there's some difficult ones. That's part of a three-game road trip for them. They'll have been in Houston two nights before. They go to Atlanta after that. They've got New York and Philadelphia in between then. And, I think it doesn't sound like Joel Embiid is going to be available for tonight, but it wouldn't be shocking if he was for Thursday. So in a vacuum, you'd rather be, Indiana just with those slight advantages. But Miami has Jimmy Butler. And I think that's the thing. You'd still want to be in Miami's boat because you have a guy that's been there and you have a guy that knows how to just carry a group through these kinds of scenarios. I mean, just what he's done in the playoffs. I mean, just trying to get yourself a good spot is, nothing new for him. And so, if you see, if you're the Heat, you're just believing that at some point you're getting that version of Jimmy Butler, you're getting playoff Jimmy, and if that starts now, you really feel good about your chances. Obviously, again, the Pacers have a lot of talent themselves. Certainly Halliburton is at some point going to make that kind of leap. You have Pascal Siakam as a guy that's won a title as well, that is going to start to, I think has increasingly mattered more in the month of March and April so far. Another guy that you can rely on, but I mean, Jimmy Butler is really special in these moments. So, I mean, if I'm Miami, I still like the fact that I've got this kind of experience. I've been to two finals in the last 4 years. I like my chances in Miami just because of the experience that I already have.
Dustin, when I look at the Pacers offensively, and I noticed this last night, it seems as though, in part of this, I don't know if it's chicken and egg. I don't know if Halliburton is creating again for them to go to a faster pace, or if the acclimation is allowing Halliburton to now go to a faster pace. But it seems to me, and then I want your opinion on this, that the acclimation period with Siakam now is getting close now to a 100% gel. In other words, understanding the pace and players not having to slow down to find out what his tendencies are. He is now fully absorbed within the offense, and that's allowing their system to run at a back to previous level pre-Siakam or closer to it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would mostly agree. I mean, the one sort of counterpoint there is Brooklyn has not decided to play well, even remotely well, against the Pacers in the two games that they played. Certainly the help that Brooklyn was on a back-to-back. I mean, Brooklyn looked like a team that was checked out last night. And so that's one of those things. And it was kind of the same when they played them before. And Siakam was dominant in that game. But there's just something to be said for the fact that there just wasn't a lot of resistance. And so, but I would say, I mean, I think you obviously have, I think, a bunch of other, pretty good examples of that. I think the Clippers game, I think, was one really good example of that, of them being able to maintain their speed and their pace. I mean, I think, the weird thing, I think, for them, Siakam's done, I think, a really good job of integrating himself. Halliburton's done a really good job of integrating himself. I think they know what he is supposed to do when they can move. I think what's interesting, what I think they're still working out, is when a team is able to successfully slow them down, when to know that's the case, or when to try to keep pushing through that, but also when to just accept that this is a night where you just pound the ball to Pascal and let him go get shots. And I think they're still trying to figure out what are the markers that tell you one way or the other there. And so I think they look a little bit more disjointed, obviously, when teams are able to successfully make it hard for them to get in the paint. The Bulls game recently was a similar scenario. Like, Chicago's really good at keeping out of the paint, and that's the best thing they do. So I think there's still some adjustment there. But I think they've certainly reached the point where, you know, Halliburton has a pretty good sense of where Siakam is going to be when they are running, and, you know, where his spots are going to be, how to get him in the best possible, you know, scenarios, and therefore how everybody else spaces around him, where Pascal has the space, you know, how everybody else fills in, you know, how, you know, Halliburton has to make things happen off the ball with movement, you know, screening for Pascal in certain circumstances. So, I mean, they've definitely integrated a lot. I mean, I think bottom line, they know how he fits when they want to play fast. I think they have to determine exactly, you know, when they have, like, when they have to know that it's time to play slow and just throw him the ball and let him go make a play.
Pacers beat writer for the Indy Star, Dustin Dupirak, nice enough to take some time with us. Dustin, to borrow off of that question that Jake just asked about pace and where they've adapted things, have they reached a point now where they have Buddy Hield-proofed the lineup? In other words, have they recovered from players knowing their role, especially from their perimeter game, without him to this point? Or are you still seeing instances where it's clear they're missing that aspect of what their offense was prior to him being dealt away?
Damn, I think both things are true. I think that you know, everybody figured out what their role is, but at the end of the day, there just isn't a Buddy Hield, and they're missing that. You know, I mean, nobody is trying to be Buddy. No one is attempting to be Buddy. No one really, frankly, can be Buddy, and that costs you a lot, and you just have to, you know, find a way to make up for that in other ways. Obviously, a big way that you make up for that is you have this, you know, incredibly multi-talented all-NBA player in Siakam that gives you a whole bunch of buckets that you weren't getting before. You know, certainly before he was acquired, you never really saw that group, you know, at its full potential with Siakam and Hield together when you had both of those guys. And obviously, they played pretty well, but you had a missing Halliburton for a lot of those cases when he was hurt or he was coming back on a minutes restriction. So you never really saw, you know, those three together, you know, and Turner also height of their powers. But I think everybody's figured out what it is they're supposed to do, because mostly it's like, hey, you know, Ben Shepherd, don't try to be Buddy Hield. You're not Buddy Hield, you know, and also for that matter, don't try to be Benedict Mathurin, because nobody, they haven't been able to necessarily replace him either. And so there is production that they have missed. You know, Halliburton obviously, again, is changing what he's doing. He's doing more sort of things that Hield did, but even he can't just do that. You know, Buddy could obviously go run and sort of sit on the wing and wait, or just do some blurring and running around and not have the ball in his hand for a possession and still make an impact. You know, Tyrese has to touch the ball. But bottom line, everybody has figured out who they are and where they fit, and I think how the offense has to be different that Hield is not there. You know, different ways they can operate. But I do think, you know, man, you definitely look out there a lot of times, man, wouldn't it be nice for them to have a high-volume movement shooter right now with that group that they could trust to, you know, knock out three or four threes in a row and get them back in this or have some kind of knockout blow. I mean, there's definitely moments where you look out and see, you know, notice that Buddy Hield is missing.
Dustin, in conclusion here, we're going to do a fun exercise. Could, and I'm going to have Eddie record it. Here's what we're going to do, and I want your permission on this. But
sure.
What I think is that would be easiest here is I'm going to record you saying your last name, and then each time we have you on, when I say your first name, we'll just play the recording of you saying the last name, and then I know we're safe. Because I want to, you know what I mean, out of respect to the whole family. Is that cool with you?
It's fine, yeah.
Okay. Here we go. On the count of three, just your last name, nice, slowly, succinctly, and clearly, and then Eddie will record it. 3, 2, 1.
Dupirak.
Okay, now hold on. When you put those all together, because then I'm like, okay, is it Dupirak or Dupirak? The ack is, where's the last syllable? It's going up or going down?
I guess it's going up. Dupirak.
Yeah. We got it on the last one. See, even I tripped you up, and you've been saying it your whole life, right?
Exactly. You're screwed up. I'm screwed up my own name now.
That's what I do, Dustin. Pacers going to be, by the way, in Brooklyn coming up tomorrow night. Take on the Nets, and all of the coverage you can read in the Indianapolis Star from Dustin. Eddie, hit it, Dustin.
I'm trying to clip it.
Dustin, I'll let you say it. You can read all of it from Dustin.
Dustin Dupirak.
There we go. It sounded different that time, I'm telling you. Something's fishy. Dustin, we appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
This song, by the way, Joan Jett, always was a fan of this song. Always thought Joan Jett was cool, then thought she was ultra cool when I found out she was in a relationship with Carmen Electra. Not anymore, but was at one time.
That's your fun fact of the day.
How about that?
Very fun.
She also had that song, Do You Want to Touch? Do you want to touch me there? Yeah. It's a great song. And then I found out she was in a relationship with Carmen Electra. I'm just saying.
Fascinated to see how this transition goes.
Well, I'm sure Stephen Holder's used to smooth transitions and thrilled to be joining the program at this point. He joins us now from ESPN. Stephen, how are you?
I'm okay, I think. I was only half listening, and then I really perked up because I started hearing some things.
Did you perk up when I mentioned that Joan Jett was in a relationship with Carmen Electra?
Yeah, I didn't know what you were talking about. I was distracted for a second, and then I got really interested, but I was lost. So, yeah.
You know what? I've got news for you, Stephen. What you just did was summarize every listener of this program 3 hours a day. Yes.
Should be the motto of the show. I was listening, and then I listened, and I got lost. There you go.
So, listen, this drives me crazy. My wife walks in the house and turns the TV on, and then I'll walk in, and I'm like, why are you watching this? Like, what? I'm like, this show, who actually watches this? Oh, no, it's just on for noise. I'm like, what? I didn't know people did that. But wait a minute.
How long have you and Shannon been married?
Exactly. Right?
You just described most people's golf experiences outside of major tournaments. Why is this on? Oh, it's just background noise. It's on, dude.
Exactly. What's wrong with quiet? I guess I'm getting old. I don't know, man.
Stephen, listen, kidding aside, and thanks for joining us, I want to begin with this. Yesterday, we learned the news of, you know, obviously the sad and untimely passing of Vontae Davis, who was a really good player for the Colts and a two-time Pro Bowler here. Seemed as though he was popular with his teammates. I did not know him. I assume that you spent some time around him or at least interviewed him. What, if anything, do we know about the details of the news, but more importantly, just the kind of person and player Vontae Davis was?
Yeah, we don't know a lot about what happened, and I really can't speculate just because, I mean, that doesn't do us any good. I talked to a couple of his former teammates, and they did not have specific answers at the time I spoke to them. I spoke to one who did talk to Vernon Davis, Vontae's older brother, but that player did not provide, you know, details to me, if any, about the cause of his death. So I don't know. I worked on the story yesterday, reached out to the medical examiner, and they, as you would expect, said that it will probably take some time before they have an official cause of death for Vontae. So that's the update there. Now, you said you didn't know him. I did know Vontae pretty well, actually, and would spend a lot of time talking to him in the locker room. I found him to be just a really interesting individual. You know, he came to Indianapolis, you know, sort of a misunderstood, I guess. You know, he was kind of an enigma in Miami. He had that very public situation on Hard Knocks that everyone has seen a clip of by now, you know, where he gets cut on camera on HBO. Or excuse me, traded, I should say. He gets informed that he's being traded on Hard Knocks. I believe he said later he wasn't aware the camera was rolling at the time. And he just had a really, you know, human response, which was like, I don't know what's happening, and I need to call my grandmother, you know, who was essentially like his mom, you know. So I think that's the context there, you know. And so anyway, that one little interaction followed him forever. And I always kind of hated it. And even teammates, we all – you know, I made jokes about it. Teammates made jokes about it. But the reality of it is, you know, we kind of reduced him to like that little 10-second interaction, which is kind of not fair. And the reason, and when I learned the story about who that woman was and what she meant to him and the role she played in the life of Vontae and Vernon and their siblings, you understand why that was his first thought. You know, like, I gotta call her, because she's the only person who can help me make sense of this. She raised those kids. Their parents were alternately in jail, drug addicts. really rough situation, and she saved those kids. So anyway, I'm getting a little off the subject. It's not really, I don't know that you asked me for that, but I think it's important in context. You know, it told you a little bit about, I think when you know the story, it tells you a little bit about who he is, or who he was, I should say, and explains the context there. The last thing I would say is that you are right, that he was very well liked by his teammates. You know, he was always a very happy individual, and that's the one thing that you always remember about him. Always in a good mood, always smiling, always really happy to be around others. Wasn't much for interviews, but definitely was always a guy who who tried to see the good in everybody and make the best of a situation. So it hit me pretty hard when it happened, when I heard that news, just because I thought I was fortunate enough to get to see the real Vontae Davis.
Stephen Holder's our guest from ESPN.com. Stephen, the last time that we talked, you were, I believe, at the, and I always forget, do we call them the owners' meetings or just the NFL meet, the off-season meetings?
I mean, it's technically the annual meeting, but the colloquial term has become the owners' meeting.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
So we will call it the annual meeting since Jim Irsay is the owner of the Colts and was not there, although I realize now the daughters are listed under ownership as well. But now that you've gotten a chance to kind of look back at it and come home from it, the takeaways just in general, if anything, that maybe you didn't anticipate being a topic of discussion or a theme there that you observed is what?
I would say just I did anticipate this, but I think the pushback on the kickoff rule was, I thought there was a lot of honesty about it, you know, from the coaching side. You definitely, and Shane Steichen even mentioned this to me, he was in a meeting early in the week about rules and proposed rule changes and what have you. And his takeaway from that was like, wow, there was a lot going on in that meeting. So I think what it confirms is what happens a lot of times at the owners' meetings, or the annual meeting, which is that coaches, executives, et cetera, well, coaches and GMs specifically, they might feel really strongly about something like, hey, we don't think this is a good change. But what it says is, if owners want to do something, it's going to happen. And the competition committee was very much on board with making that change, and they sold it really hard to the owners group, and they were moving forward with that change. You know, they had the endorsement of Roger Goodell clearly. And so it doesn't mean they're wrong. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that it tells you who kind of wears the pants, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, and the owners are in charge, man, and they will do things over the protest of their coaches, basically their subordinates. I remember one year, I can't remember what rule it was, and so I'm not going to tell the story in a perfect fashion, but I remember one year, years ago, also in Orlando, I don't remember what year, but in the 2010s, there was a rule change proposed that the coaches were not in favor of. And they used to have the meeting used to cover a longer period of days. And I remember they had a golf outing for the coaches one morning. And while the coaches were on the course playing, they passed the rule over their objections. They got off the course and like, what the hell just happened? So it's like, hey, buddy, you know, you're a subordinate, even though you're the head coach, you're still a subordinate. And it was kind of hilarious because, you know what, they felt like the rest of us, you know, we all have bosses and we all work for somebody. And for at least that moment, 32 NFL head coaches had something in common with the rest of us.
Stephen Holder is our guest, covers the NFL and the Colts for ESPN.com. Stephen, I know I'm about to open up a can of worms in regards to the way that rule changes happen in the league, but I'm curious for your thoughts on this because it was once again in some variety, I believe, proposed by the Colts in terms of just a variation of calls being looked at or calls being reviewed. Across the pond, in a sport that I know, even though it's continuing to rise, vast majority of our listeners and certainly of Americans, it's our football. It's not their football that is the real one, right? Soccer's not still not anywhere near the level of the NFL in this country. That said, for about the last 15 years, and it's still been met with controversy, they have used a thing called VAR, or video assistant referee, who's basically their sole job is, like kind of the NBA does in Secaucus and the NFL does as well in their replay center, is to always be looking at the monitor. And if they see something, whether it was like a handball in soccer or offsides, they can whistle down. It can be looked at and reviewed. Are we ever at a point, as video review continues to be, and there's like a dedicated department, not just Gene Steratour on CBS, there's a dedicated department of referees somewhere else, offside or wherever, monitoring the game? Are we ever approaching a breaking point where the league might say, you know what, maybe something like VAR, where a video assistant referee could change pass interference when you know it's clearly the right call there or needs to be the call there, could be implemented in the NFL?
So, great question. So, there hasn't been any obvious momentum toward that in the NFL. However, I would submit that the more technology advances and the more access we have to instant video of things that happened that were not addressed, I think the harder it becomes for them to not make some kind of move towards something like that. I don't know that it would take on the same form as you're talking about in international soccer, but or European soccer, but it certainly, I think, begs the question that they're going to have to, or a question they're going to have to deal with, which is how do you square that, right? I mean, if you have the technology, you have the ability, why not? I know what the answers would be to that question from the league. The answer would be there is so much that's subjective, and that is true, right? That's one of the reasons they don't want to, for example, deal with penalties by replay for the most part. Like, you remember a few years ago,
sure,
there was a temporary shift toward allowing teams to challenge pass interference calls.
And more often than not, the league defended it, its own officials. Very rarely did you ever see those win.
Right. And it's largely because they don't want to completely undermine the official because, right, look, I mean, pass interference is a very, very, very subjective call. One of the most subjective calls, right? But that doesn't mean there aren't some issues that are less gray, you know, and I think that's where it could be implemented. But there is a Pandora's box element. You are correct, which is, okay, where do you draw the line? What is reviewable? What isn't reviewable? You know, how does it impact the game when it comes to stopping the clock? Whatever, right? There's all these little unintended consequences, maybe, that they're afraid of, and those are actual understandable fears. Okay, I get it, but I also think ultimately, what I said initially, I think is the biggest thing, which is I can, even if there's not a replay, I can go on Twitter and within 90 seconds of a play, get a snapshot of it and see it over and over and over, yeah, and retweet it to thousands and millions of people. And so what happens at the end? The NFL is sitting there looking like complete idiots.
Yeah, that's why they changed it overseas, because they wanted to protect their own referees in that sport, because mm-hmm. you could get it in the blink of an eye and know, oh, that's a wrong call.
Right. So ultimately, what the NFL is doing, while I understand it, the counter argument is, well, it makes you look really bad. So does it really help you in the long run, right? Does it engender confidence in how you're governing your sport? So those are really thorny issues that they're going to have to deal with. And again, it's going to get harder and harder as the technology continues to advance. I mean, we're probably already there, right? The technology is certainly available, but I mean, it's getting even better all the time. So that is not an excuse any longer. It's more about, do they have the willingness?
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Stephen Holder's our guest, by the way, from ESPN. You and I have had conversations that are not sports related at times, very deep ones, right? That's a fact,
sure,
correct?
Certainly.
Okay. So
you don't? Do you even like sports, Jacob? Like, no, I'm kidding. Listen, I need a break from sports as much as you do. So they're welcome conversations.
Well, so here's why I mentioned that, because for those that are just joining the program or not, you know, have not previously listened, where have you been? I want them to know that we're friends and you're a friend of the show. So when I suddenly jerk the wheel like really hard to the left, you know, it's not like, well, I can't believe they're putting this poor guy in this position. This is what we do, right?
Right.
Earlier,
right,
we were talking about Airbnbs. Now, you've stayed in Airbnbs, right?
A couple times, okay. Yes.
So I was discussing Airbnbs at what I predict to be a decline in the business of the Airbnbs or like thereof. And I got this text, and I just want to know, because you're a smart fellow, smarter than myself, and you're worldly in your knowledge, if this is even possible. Jake, my name is Barry. Just want to let you know, I contracted syphilis by using a towel from an Airbnb. Thank you.
Oh,
now, is
God.
That possible? Do we know if that's possible?
I
don't think
no
that's possible,
idea.
Is it?
Now I am used to you jerking the wheel. Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that aspect based on the text here. Thank you.
I should use different language here, but whatever. The point is,
dangerous game.
I'm used to you, you know, taking sharp turns. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But even for you.
Blame Barry. I mean, Barry just sent this to me. But I'm not sure. My question, and it says, literally, he said, because Jake, my name is Barry, so he's okay with me using the name. I contracted syphilis by using a towel from an Airbnb. Thank you. And then he has thank you in there. Now, I don't think, and I don't think the Airbnb is at fault here. I think Barry, it maybe like had to tell his significant other that, but I don't think that you can get that from a towel, can you? Do we know this?
You wouldn't think, right? You wouldn't think.
Yeah, I'm looking right here.
I mean, it's called a sexually transmitted disease.
You cannot get it from sharing food or drinks, hugging, holding hands, coughing, sneezing, or sharing towels.
Well, we don't know what he was
right
doing
here
with the towel. I mean,
that's fair.
Who's to say?
But you know what? You know what? This is actually an interesting topic for me, because you'd be surprised. This is maybe surprising to some people. I don't know. But I actually have almost never used Airbnb, only like a couple times ever. And I travel a lot, but I think it's because I've been a heavy traveler over the years. I've played the points game.
Correct.
You know,
I think,
and
that's a big thing for people, right?
Yeah. So I honestly have never, I've never really made the transition to, you know, to Airbnb or Vrbo or something like that. You know, I've done it when I've gone somewhere with friends and somebody else makes the reservation and they get us, a place with multiple bedrooms. I've done that a few times and that's worked out fine. I had no issues with it. But it's not my first instinct, like, whatsoever.
Now, so, Jake, my name is Barry, and I do not have syphilis. That's another text I'm getting. I'm with you, though, Stephen. I think, in all honesty, I think the hotel part of it, and again, I know I keep going back to this, like people that travel a lot for work, you just become accustomed and used to the familiarity and the comfort level of a particular place, and then you obviously get the points for it, so you just never deviate out of that, right?
Yeah, and you also have like a baseline expectation of what you're going to get for the most part, right? So like, okay, I have, this is, no one asked for this, but I'm going to just tell you. So I have like lifetime Marriott status because I've been traveling for like,
you're a Bonvoy guy. Years. I thought so. If I was to guess, you're in the Bonvoy club for sure.
So I have lifetime titanium status. So basically I'm God at Marriott. Okay. Like they bow down to me when I walk in. Like I'm not giving that up, you know? Like,
totally agree.
No, and the worst part about it, though, also off the subject, but we're getting way off the subject here. But like when you log into your profile, this is a good and bad thing. It gives you like, hey, here's your lifetime stats, you know, X number of points and X number of nights. When I look at the number of nights I've stayed, it's like 4 years of my life. And I'm like, I got to get another career. This is terrible. I'm like 1,200 nights, man. I'm like, what is this?
Is the point system the most underrated aspect of being a person in sports that has to travel a lot?
Underrated?
Yeah, that gets overlooked, I feel like, at
times,
right?
You know what? The rental car points add up, too, though.
Yeah, all right.
I mean,
Yeah, I played the rental car game. I do it all. Like I don't screw around. I had good mentors early in my career, and they were like, "You better never leave anything on the table." So I've now preached that to my younger colleagues. Like, wait, you're staying at Hilton and a Marriott next week? Like, what are you doing? Like, you're a moron. So pick a lane, you know. So, but yes, I think the points are great. However, like everything else in today's day and age, everything's gotten watered down. You know, so my Sky Miles is not worth what it used to be. My hotel points are not worth what they used to be. They keep raising what it costs to redeem either flights or rooms, all that stuff. So, I mean, Jake, you travel a good bit for work too, so you know how this goes. So it's not what it used to be. I used to be able to, like, pick up the phone on Friday, just because we had nothing to do on the weekend. It'd be like, hey, you want to go somewhere this weekend?
Oh, yeah, that's the best. That. Now, Stephen, like, here's the thing. You're getting into the inflation conversation, and the people across the hall are getting excited about it. They're wanting to book you for tomorrow, as a matter of fact, right?
That's right. I think it's those politicians in Washington watering down my Marriott.
Now, speaking of Washington, perfect segue. Thank you much. A guy that was signed on to be their starting quarterback now signs as a backup in Kansas City, talking about Carson Wentz. Is this his ultimate destiny now? Is Carson Wentz now relegated to career backup?
Yeah, I think until he gets an opportunity and proves otherwise, yes. You know, that can change, maybe. I guess maybe. But I don't know what it would take. It would take something dramatic. And, you know, and frankly, I don't know what that would even be. So, yes, I do agree that he is a backup until further notice, and that there likely won't be any further notice. And here's the thing. I mean, it's actually not a terrible spot for him, because you know that he's a competent quarterback. Just to use the term loosely, right? I mean, like, you know, okay, this guy has been around the NFL. He knows, he understands the game. If you ask him to run a scheme, he's probably executed it before, you know. So those things make you comfortable when it comes to a backup quarterback who's not going to get a lot of practice time. He's got to be able to go in and just, you know, figure it out.
This is from – go ahead, Steven.
That's
continue.
My bad. Saying you're a starter, though. That I'm not putting my eggs in the basket of Carson Wentz, though.
To your point about perspective changing, and this is just, again, another take on it on Twitter, but – Trey Wingo had tweeted about the signing last night and said, and this is true, the Chiefs actually wanted to sign Wentz last season as Mahomes' backup, but Wentz still saw himself as a starter. Clearly his perspective has changed, that from Trey Wingo. To your point about that, at some point, every quarterback has to look in the mirror and realize it's a crossroad. Are you going to continue to fight for being a starter in this league, or are you kind of accepting that this is really your destiny?
Yeah, I mean, I remember Jacoby Brissett, different situation, clearly. You know, he was never seen as anyone's franchise quarterback, but, you know, he got a taste of it here in Indianapolis. And I remember him kind of going through this process of having to come to terms with, okay, what am I? And what do people see me as? Because what I see myself as is irrelevant to a degree. You know, what I think of me, that doesn't matter to someone else. And the rest of the NFL was saying to him, look, we think you're a very high-level backup quarterback, and we'll pay you pretty good money to do it. But that's it. And so there came a point where he embraced that and said, you know what, I can do this for 10 more years and make a hell of a lot of money. And so he's continued to do that and has been a mentor and a leader in every locker room he's gone to. And I do think, yes. I mean, Carson Wentz can do that too. And maybe this is the beginning of him doing that. You know, if you do it and it works out well, you can continue to get that call every year, you know? And so you saw last year, he sat on the sidelines for quite some time before he got an opportunity. And then when he took that opportunity and seemed to embrace it, here now it leads to another opportunity to do it behind the best quarterback we've seen in our generation. So it'll be interesting.
It's about being who you see yourself as, which is why Stephen Holder walks into ice cream places and says, I'm Stephen Holder, Bonvoy God. I get an extra dip, please.
Yeah,
the folks at Marriott see me as a god, I believe was the quote, right?
It, It's the only place I matter at all, okay? Including my own home. Okay, so listen, let me have this.
Steven, next thing on the docket will be obviously the draft. We'll talk to you between now and then, but I guess in conclusion, do you see any signs of a forecast that the Colts might throw a curveball at us when it comes to the draft?
No, I think the only potential curveball, and I don't even classify it as one, is a trade down scenario. Look, I mean, there's always the possibility of trading up, but, you know, let me know when Chris Ballard actually does that. I mean, that's not his thing. So he has traded down and has done that multiple times. I think it just depends. Frankly, I don't anticipate that. I think this draft is setting up well for them, where they're in position to get a really potentially elite player at number 15, potentially, right? They're all potentially elite. But this is – a couple things are happening. Number one, the quarterbacks are stacking up very early. There's some offensive linemen stacking up as well. The receivers, to a degree. Well, I mean, that's only two or three positions you're talking about that are going to be flying off the board, possibly. And it's only 14 picks. So that doesn't leave a lot of slots for other positions. So you're going to have the number one prospect at multiple positions still on the board when the Colts get up there to pick, in my estimation. So if I'm them, I sit tight and I just see, you know, what comes to me. But if the phone rings, Chris Ballard will answer and he will contemplate. That's all I'm saying.
Steven, we appreciate the time, as always. I'm going to do further medical research on the towel situation. I don't think you have to worry in your hotels, but we'll let you know, right?
Yeah, please do. I'm waiting for the update on this. Eagerly awaiting.
I think Barry's trip involved more than just the Airbnb. Steven, appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
See you guys.
All right, Steven Holder from ESPN.com.